Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio, your source for acceptance, enrichment, inspiration, and empowerment within the autism and Asperger's communities. Our show will be starting shortly. To listen to archives of previous broadcasts, visit www.autismempowerment.org and click the Autism Empowerment Radio tab. As a nonprofit charity, we rely on public generosity to fund our programs, special events, and support services. Thank you for considering a tax-deductible donation today. Our show is now beginning.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio. My name is Karen Krajcik, co-founder and executive director of Autism Empowerment. We are a 501c3 public charity, and we're dedicated to making life better and more meaningful for individuals and families in the autism and Asperger communities locally, regionally, and worldwide. We serve all ages and abilities, and we promote four foundational pillars of positivity: accept, enrich, inspire, and empower. Today's show recording date is Friday, May 3rd, 2013. We just finished Autism Acceptance Month, although autism acceptance never has an ending in our home and in our organization. And I'll have to say, though, that the month that we just had was absolutely incredible. So many different activities, so much positivity, lots of wonderful things. On Wednesday, April 30th, that was earlier this week, John Krajcik and I did, or was that Tuesday? Well, anyway, John Krajcik and I did an Autism Empowerment, Autism Acceptance Month recap show. So if you missed that, you can go ahead and listen to it on demand, because that was a really good show, very positive. Not only did we talk about the previous month, but also where autism empowerment is heading. So if you're not that familiar with our nonprofit organization, or if you are somewhat familiar and you want to become more active in the autism empowerment community, which really is a community that belongs to all of us, please be sure to tune in for that. We also invite you, after the show, to visit our website at www.autismempowerment.org and subscribe for free to our Autism Empowerment radio station. You can do that either here through blogtalkradio.com/autismempowerment, or if you happen to be listening on demand or on someone's mobile device, if you go to your favorite search engine, you can type in Autism Empowerment Radio iTunes into Google or your favorite search engine, and that will bring up our iTunes feed where you can subscribe from there and download shows to your favorite mobile device. We also have a sister station, which is also part of Autism Empowerment. That's Autism and Scouting Radio. And if you have an interest in scouting and how we play into that, please feel free to check that station out as well. So while you are visiting our website and while you're plugging in, we want to make sure that you know that you are part of our community, and we want you to connect with us. And one way that you can do that is through our Facebook page. If you are not Facebook inclined, we have Twitter. If you're not Twitter inclined, we do have our website as well where we list special events. We are going to be upgrading that in hopefully the near future. We're getting some consulting on that. It kind of also depends on funds and time. You know how nonprofits work a lot of times, but we are doing our absolute best to be able to grow an organization that serves people in a positive way. You know, our vision itself is an engaged autism and Asperger's community. What we're looking to do is connect individuals and families, connect educators and care providers with valuable resources that they can use that are meaningful, but we also want to connect you with each other. So we provide free or very low-cost events, programs, trainings, and services. And people sometimes ask, okay, so what sets Autism Empowerment apart from another autism organization? What do you guys do that's so special? And, you know, I believe it's, you know, our community, partly. I believe it is our foundation of positivity, partly. Part of it is because, you know, everybody that is on our board of directors is either on the autism spectrum or related to someone who is. But I really think, you know, you combine those things together and our real attitude towards promoting acceptance and enrichment and inspiration and empowerment. They're not buzzwords for us. They're words of meaning. And we really want our community to know that we're there for them. I am on the autism spectrum. I was diagnosed after my children. My youngest son is currently almost 7. He's 6. And my oldest son is 13. And one was diagnosed at the time, quote-unquote, classical autism. One is, I would say, probably considered Asperger's, or as the, well, with the DSM changing this year, it will all be under the autism spectrum disorder umbrella. So to us, you know, call us by our names, but, you know, not our labels necessarily. But we take those with pride. I don't mind being called an Aspie. I don't mind being called autistic. And I tell people that a lot of times. People get hung up on words, first person, that stuff. Person with autism, autistic, Aspie, person with Asperger's. You know, the person who actually coined the word Aspie was Dr. Leanne Holiday Willey, someone on the spectrum herself. So a lot of times I know that people get hung up on words, but it's really about tone. It's really about attitude and respect and acceptance. So don't get hung up on the words, folks. Get hung up on the acceptance and making sure that you let people know you care about them. And to me, putting people first is showing acceptance. And that isn't so much, you know, sometimes with words, we can all get fumbled with our words, you know. But it's in our attitude and our actions. So that's kind of my piece here for today. I did want to let you know that our special show today is actually part 2 of 2 in a series. Although I'm recording this introductory part live here on May 3rd, the main portion of our show today is from an interview that I taped with Carla Fisher at Intel on April 6th. We're actually playing the first part of this interview that we taped second. In other words, we taped about two hours when I was out there at Intel. And it turned out that the second hour that I taped with her, it seemed to have a little bit more background information. And it really seemed to fit more for a good first broadcast for those of you that might not be familiar with Carla Fisher. And so this particular interview is our part 2, which was actually taped first, so there's a little tweaking to be done with the audio and so forth, so bear with us on that. In the first interview, just so that you know, so that you can listen to that separately, that played on Autism Empowerment Radio just a couple weeks ago, and it's available on demand. If you're looking for the title, it's Carla Fisher, Carla's ASD Autism Spectrum Disorder page. And if you're not that familiar with Carla, she is an adult autistic who, in her words, is not fighting autism but working with it. She's a senior program manager and engineering manager at Intel and has worked in the high-tech field for over 20 years and is very passionate about tech, very passionate about her job. In our first show, she covered a variety of topics, including what it was like for her growing up, and how things changed for her after her father passed away and she received an autism diagnosis. She also discussed the conceding phase where she tried to fix her autism, which was actually rather fascinating. And she talks a bit about meeting with Michelle Garcia Winner and other people where she was working very hard to try to fix her autism, but no longer tries to do that. She works with it and helps others. Other topics of that first interview was the importance of autistics supporting other autistics and how that isn't always the case sometimes when you go to Facebook parent groups. Carla believes, and we believe, and a lot of adult advocates believe that if you really want to be able to teach your children, teach your teens, teach people about autism, it's important, no, not important, it's imperative that you have adults that are on the spectrum in the conversation. Now, generally adults on the spectrum, a lot of us like to call ourselves Aspie, autistic. Some of us like to call ourselves person with autism. Quite frankly, you know, I don't get hung up on that stuff. Just call me Karen. But it's really, you know, Carla Fisher is an amazing advocate, self-advocate, and adult advocate in the autistic community. And she has a page on Facebook. you're not familiar with it, it's Carla's ASD page. And we have a link on our website. In fact, if you go to autismempowerment.org and you happen to check our women's resource page, we have a lot of great women's resources there. We've got Jennifer Cook O'Toole, Dr. Leanne Holiday-Willey, a lot of really good stuff. And Carla's page, ASD page, is there too. It's an excellent resource. She does a lot of educational slides on her website. She has a wiki. She is very open about talking about a lot of topics of a serious nature. And in fact, what thing that's kind of cool and why we decided to go ahead and run this interview today is that, Carla, you have an opportunity, if you are in the Portland, Oregon area, to have a chance to listen to Carla tomorrow. The Autism Society of Oregon on Saturday, May 4th, is having a Path to Employment workshop from 1 to 5 p.m. The doors open at 12:30 at the Amphitheater at Providence Cancer Center, which is at 4805 Northeast Gleason Street in Portland, Oregon, 97213. There's going to be presentations by Peter Fitzgerald and Deborah McClain, and they're going to be talking about the planning and preparation for employment, strategies for overcoming challenges that autistic individuals face in employment. And then after the presentations, there's going to be a panel discussion with adults on the autism spectrum who are discussing their own career paths and experiences. And Carla is one of those panelists. Another person is Dora Raymaker, and a third is Matt Sloan, who I have personally worked with. He was on one of the Autism Empowerment panels last year as well. Really great guy. He's a really interesting person to listen to. And the facilitator of that panel is Barbara Avila. So if you want information on that, you can go ahead and call 1-888-AUTISM-1 or visit the AutismSocietyOregon.org website, and be sure to tune into that. And if you just happen to be in the Vancouver area, our friends over at Big Al's are having a sensory bowling day. This is their first one, and that is going to be from 9 to 10 a.m. That's at 16615 Southeast 18th Street in Vancouver. Bowling's going to be a lot of fun. There's no reservations required. It's $2 for bowling and $2 for shoe rental. And I believe they are also going to do that sensory-friendly bowling at the Beaverton location as well. And, yes, we're going to get started here in just a moment. I just wanted to get through my announcements. On Monday, May 6th, if you're in the Vancouver area, SEPSTA, the Special Education Parent Teacher Student Association, is having their last meeting of the school year from 6 to 7 at Eleanor Roosevelt Elementary School Media Center. And the special guest is going to be Melinda Thompson of Paid. So if you're interested in that, visit SEPSTA on Facebook. If you're not familiar with their link, you can check the autismempowerment.org website, and we have links to them there as well. So that's a little bit about our upcoming events, and now I am going to go back and I am going to play the recording that we did at Intel with Carla. Now this is a bit raw, so be patient, be kind, listen in, and I hope you enjoy what we talk about today. Actually, I let Carla do most of the talking, and some of the topics that we covered were her abilities as an acoustic savant, which is very fascinating, but two topics which are near and dear to Carla's heart in educating others are autism token theory, sometimes known as spoon theory, and autistic burnout, which is something that you do not hear very often unless you are on an adult autism board. It's very serious in nature, and I'll just go ahead and let Carla speak to that. So we're going to go ahead and get started with that portion of the interview, and I will come back at the end of that part of the after the end of the broadcast and finish out the show for you. So thank you very much, and please enjoy the rest of the show.
So in the dentistry, in the classical guitar world, long before I knew anything about, autism, I was known as an acoustic savant. I could listen to an instrument, a classical guitar instrument, and with very high degree of accuracy, tell you the tone was used for the backs the sides, and the top. And on top of that, I can almost always guess accurately.
Okay, I'm not sure why that stopped. Let me go ahead and check here again. Yay, technology.
That test to see.
Yeah, so we're just doing tests on all these different ones, and then we'll make sure that the quality that comes out, like we want to make sure we have a mic.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, I thought we had this edited. Okay, so let's go ahead and improvise. You know, guys out there, there's one thing that I have to say. As a mom of two children on the spectrum and being on the spectrum myself, you have to learn to expect the unexpected and go with the flow. Even though sometimes our children and even ourselves may have trouble with flexibility and we want to keep on routine and have nice structure, sometimes things just don't go as planned. And I am embarrassed by this, but we're going to go ahead and deal with it. So I am going to try here, since we're in the middle of the show live, I'm going to try to play this again. And I think what you're going to end up hearing now for the first, oh, I'd say 50 seconds after I start talking is us trying to get the microphones all set up. So that would be a good time if you need to take a quick break to get a drink of water, and then we'll go straight back into Carla. Thank you so much.
I'm looking at mic placement right now. You and I are talking. I'm looking at the bars.
To see how it's showing up.
Now you're really quiet. So if you were to speak.
If I were just to talk in a normal tone of voice, it would record appropriately.
Try again.
If I were to record the normal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so now we're kind of even. So the idea is in this conversation, we want to be evenly matched because you don't want me blowing you out, vice versa. So let's go ahead and listen to that. Let's listen to this. As a savant, an acoustic savant, actually. So that's a. I'm going to turn this on as well. Make sure I'm recording. Yeah. So in this industry, in the classical guitar world, long before I knew anything about, autism, I was known as an acoustic savant. I could listen to, or I can still today, listen to an instrument, a classical guitar instrument, and with very high degree of accuracy, tell you the tone was used for the backs, the sides, and the top. And on top of that, I can almost always guess accurately the type of bracing that's used just by listening to it. And, you know, everybody thought this was a fluke at first, but, you know, they had me, you know, tested me many, many times on this. There was recently a fun little Stradivarius test, you know, can test which violin is a Strat, which one's within 5 seconds of listening to the two samples identified. It was so that clear to me. Whereas, you know, the whole point of that exercise was to say, you know, most people can't
have it. They're like, oh, no, we can't have it.
Right. So, you know, that kind of hearing, that precision of hearing is what started me in technology, actually, believe it or not, because I was an audio SB, spy in the Marine Corps. That's why I did it in NSA. I was able to hear the words and things being said, the patterns, and then I was able to take the patterns and identify them into, you know, meaningful messages, right? So
right.
Those things enabled me to be successful in technology to start. My very first patent was in audio acoustic technology. And so, you know, then it went downhill from there, obviously. Right? But that, you know, so it was that very thing. But in the back, tying us back to classical guitar, I had people fly from all over the world to come to Portland to buy their instrument next to me. Because Portland is a mecca for handmade instrument makers. It's in fact, one of the most renowned makers in the world, his name is Jeffrey Elliott, is right here in Portland, and he and a bunch of others, the guys, there must be 20 or 30 of them in the area, right? They all got to know me very well because I would bring buyers to them, and I would help the buyers select the guitar that most closely resonated with what they said they liked. Yeah, no, I could have done that for a living.
I was going to say, you would have been it.
I did it for free because it's fun. I try not to ever mix money and hobbies because then they become not hobbies anymore. It becomes more complicated than I care to get involved with. But yeah, no, it was an incredible thing. And in fact, the instrument I play today is a $12,000 instrument, and it was gifted to me by a luthier who was so amazed with my overall, not just savant abilities, but also my overall connection with the music and the industry. He gifted me this instrument, and that story really fascinated me. I flew to San Francisco, his shop. He was the one guy that was actually outside, but still Pacific Northwest. I flew to San Francisco to his shop, and he had on his counter about 20 or 30 different boards, just regular boards, and he would tap them and said, "What do you hear?" And he just wanted to hear, and he would write down what I said, just the boards themselves. And he had them numbered, and at the end of that exercise, I went home. 4 months later, he had a guitar, but we never talked about anything outside of that exercise. He just made this guitar. And he sat down and he played the guitar and identified the numbers of the boards that he made. And I recognized that as board number. And I, because the wood carries through that tap tone of the board. That's how strongly it carries through to the instrument itself and how strongly, how important that part is. Anyway, we digress.
Oh, no, but I found this fascinating. When did you first learn that you had that ability to be able to tell the difference? I mean, were you involved in music in school? Or did you just kind of, how did it
No, that's an autism story, actually. that would be, this is one of the stories that I say that's really powerful, how it ties directly to my autism. When I was young, I was... To put this in the context, understand that I am not mildly affected by autism, but pretty moderately affected at best. But when I was a young person, I was very, very, very rigid about my ideas. And that, when I say young person, I'm talking all the way into my 20s, to the point where I was in France, and I thought art and music was stupid. It was just stupid to me. There was no use for it in the world. I was in France. I refused to go into an art museum. Think about that. I was in the Smithsonian Instrument. Refused to go. I absolutely would not go anywhere near the art. I mean, I alienated all my friends because I wouldn't, you know, I was so unreasonable about it. Even, you know, if I thought something stupid, no way. I went to the Grand Canyon once and looked at it. It was like, okay, it's a big hole. And then I was angry for the rest of the trip.
You had to go and look at the big hole.
That was totally a big stupid hole. Right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if the parents can probably relate to this, right? But I was in my 20s like this, okay? And then in my 30s, I was still like this. But I was surviving pretty well because I found high tech, and I was really moving along in a quote, acceptable way. And then when my children were raised, and, you know, I was raising kids, right? So I was so involved in my 60-hour work week and the kids thing that the music, whatever, art thing was only just kind of a blip on the radar. I didn't have art in my house, right? I had whiteboards in my house, and my kids weren't allowed to listen to music. They had to listen to headphones. But that kind of thing was not, I think it was weird, but okay. When my kids grew up, I decided, and I hit my 40s, I decided that I was going to do three things with my life. One was get my finances in order because I needed to, you know, just get that part of my life. That's another thing that I had, you know, houses foreclosed on me, and I'm really, really, really bad with money even today. I have to get my bosses and my friends and stuff to, you know, really help me with bills. So I said I was going to get people. I was going to hire a team, right? I needed a team in the area. So finances, and I went to, you know, classes, which did me no good, so now I have a team. So I spent my whole 40s finding that team for finances. The other thing was my physical fitness, and I wanted to get that up. because I had let myself go a lot in my 30s. In fact, I was morbidly obese by the time I was in my early 40s. And I said, okay, I'm going to fix that. I'm going to become an athlete again. I'm going to get myself back to shape so I have quality of life at some age. And then the third facet was I said, I'm going to learn art, learn about art. I said, I have to do that. So when I was very young, in fact, when I was 5, my parents had me in music lessons. They put me in a piano lesson. And I was immediately pegged by that teacher as a musician savant, musician, and she wanted me to go the fast pace all the way to Juilliard. I didn't like it. I didn't want anything to do with it, right? So I fought my parents for several years on that, and my father had a really bad temper. We would call those meltdowns now, but he had a real bad temper, and he would make it not fun for me, the whole piano thing. Mm-hmm. So I basically, and I didn't want the piano. I wanted to learn violin. Mom, I want to learn, no, piano. So anyway, they finally let me quit that, but my brother picked up a guitar, and he played it, so I picked it up beside him, and I would kind of look at it a little bit, but I wasn't interested in the music. It hurts my ears, but I didn't realize that, but the normal guitar music with the strumming, that all hurts my ears, like rock, pop, none of that music is good. But I could, like, look at the notes, and that was fascinating to me, and I could, like, get into these little tiny ditties. And one day, I was playing my brother's guitar, and his music teacher heard me, and he talked me into taking lessons, which I did for just a very short while, and then I kind of fell out of love with that, too. But as I left, he said to me, promise me one day that you will pick up a classical guitar. And I made that promise, and I was, gosh, I don't know, 11, 12 years old or something. So because of that promise, that was the instrument I decided to go and fulfill that promise and take. And I said, so I went to the guitar center, picked up a classical guitar, hit the string, listened to the, and I'm getting chills talking about it today. And I knew from the because you can hear in every note that's played, I can hear the entire range of the scale. It starts flat, goes into the note, goes out to the note. There's an entire octave with each note. It's that complex and that wonderful and that amazing, and never looks back. So, interesting. Here's where the autism part plays into it. The interesting part about it is that about 5 or 6 months after, gosh, maybe even sooner, of picking up this instrument and playing it and starting to really get into it, and of course I went into it very obsessively, you know, easily 20 hours a week. And by the way, I was performing small concerts in only a year. So, but within like 3 months, I started to notice things around my farm that I'd never seen before. Like, was that tree there? You know, the whole world was different. Colors were different.
You were seeing things.
I was seeing things that I'd never seen before. And seeing the whole world through this whole new filter. So I was experiencing the plasticity that, you know, everybody writes about. I'm experiencing this real time. I mean, it was almost like every day my filter would change. It would adjust, and things would get brighter and more vivid and more freaking awesome. It's freaking awesome. And one of the reasons why I say, you know, hey, if you can talk your autistic kids into doing a variety of things, do that. Mm-hmm. How do you talk them into it? I don't know. I was pretty much. I was a real ass. I mean, you know, for a very, very long time. So, had my parents allowed me to take violin, I think that would have done the job that needed to be done back when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the piano, I was so against learning. But had I been able to take the instrument I wanted to take, I think it would have at least...
It would have been a different...
Exactly. Yeah. Then that plasticity would have happened earlier. Right? Then I'd be normal. No, kidding. Just kidding.
It's interesting, though, that you say that, because it's like, what kind of
path would you have been on? It's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned that you wanted to play the violin. Well, in my family, I had to play the violin, and I wanted to play the saxophone.
See?
But they wouldn't let me play the saxophone because I needed to have voices, and somehow that wasn't going to fit with the saxophone.
Okay. So yours was actually kind of an intelligent.
Yeah, I didn't see it that way.
Yeah.
I still took it as a personal affront and just decided I wasn't going to, learn this. But I'm so glad that you were able to, keep that promise, which I think that is something that most of us on the spectrum have this tremendous honesty. If we make a promise, we're going to keep it. And it may not be right away, maybe 10, 20, 30 years down the road, but we're going to keep it.
That was 40 when I started the classical guitar.
Now, are there any other promises like that of talents or different types of things that you said that you would try or do that?
I can't think of any, but, honestly, that promise didn't hang with me so much until the connection was made. My mind is sort of like, I view it like stars, dots, if you will, or folders, files, sound bites in computers, right? So the information, I think all brains are like this. The information is there. You don't necessarily lose it, per se, but you have to light up around that information in order for it to be retrieved, So you ask that question in the context of nothingness, and nothingness comes out. But if you ask that question in the context of the promise that I did make, and it will light up that memory, right? And that's what happened here, is that I knew I had to do art. I knew that art was pictures. I knew that it was music. As soon as I hit music, I started thinking of my guitar, of my piano, and all these, bad memories, and then the guitar, and then those words. I saw his face. I saw, everything. And I was like, that's what I'm going to go fulfill that. So. Yeah,
that's really awesome. Have you by chance heard of Michael Tolleson or Jack Carl Anderson? They have a Heart of the Spectrum Autistic Community Arts Center up in Seattle.
Yeah, I think I have heard of them.
I had recently interviewed both gentlemen, and they came to know about their artistic savant talent, and it was in their late 40s as well. So whereas they didn't really, Michael especially, he can paint these paintings in less than an hour. Incredible things.
Yeah.
And but he hadn't known of that ability until later on in life. And I find it amazing at what we have the capacity to do that we may not have even given the chance to do. So giving our children the opportunity to explore and try out different things, I think is really, if you can get them to do it,
It's critical. It's a really good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, how do you get them to do it? Well, a little bit of push and a little bit of pull, right? And I believe had my parents allowed me to start with a violin,
That would have made things.
It would have made a lot of difference. Yeah.
With our youngest, he really likes cars. So anytime we want to get him involved in something, whether it be music or math or something, we equate that. Okay, let's bring the cars into it.
Right.
Maybe it'll be a song about cars, or maybe we're going to do math problems with cars, or just different types of things.
Right, and you get the different vectors along the same subject. I think that's a really good way to approach. I had a horse fascination when I was a child. I still have a horse. I actually have a horse right now. Went through a period of, the equestrian. In fact, I quit my job in high tech to be a horse person for a while.
I did?
Yeah. And I did very, very well at it, but I miss the brain trust that I'm surrounded by here all the time. Intel's a really, really fun place to work if you happen to have the IQ for it, because it's a place like none other where you get to be challenged like nowhere else. And no matter how smart you think you are, you come in here, you're pretty humbled. It keeps me humble. I just missed that when I retired from high tech. I retired from high tech in my early 40s and came back to it. And I love it to death. I mean, it's going to kill me if I don't retire within the next decade, because it's so
high pressure, a lot of hours and all that.
Yeah, it's just high pressure. I mean, there's there's so much excitement and energy that goes on, and mm-hmm. but you're using your brain so much. I'm really tired at the end of the day, and for me, you know, I have nothing left, you know, mm-hmm. for anything else, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it will ultimately kill me. I need to take that very seriously. There's more than just a little bit of threat about being an autistic person and being under so much pressure all the time,
mm-hmm.
and so much working so hard all the time.
Yeah.
And you know, this is a topic I know you wanted to cover, was autistic burnout.
Yeah. Yeah. I do.
And it's not a myth. You won't read about it in scientific medicine because scientists largely have ignored adults and what adults are saying, and doctors, right, and all of the current documentation. So I think we're probably 5 years or so away from hearing about this from on a research basis, but I think, getting people to listen. I hold a quarterly event here at Intel where I invite professionals only, and I talk to them about topics like these. Topics like, how do you control your autistic demographic when in research? Topics like autistic burnout. Topics like, what are the real root causes of this thing you guys are all clumping together called social communication? Right? What are those root causes? Because I have news for everybody, and all the autistic adults as well who are jumping on the bandwagon, all right? It isn't just the social communication disorder, nor is it really about social communication. It's more about sensory processing.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about the tokens that we talk about. It's more about context. And it's more about feeling safe or anxiety than it is about this big thing you guys are all lumping together calling social, or these guys are lumping together called social communication. Because when you lump it like that, it doesn't help you or them to help us.
Right.
Right? So I'm talking right now, like I'm envisioning myself in this auditorium talking to these professionals.
I see that, actually.
So it's really important that professionals hear this, and I have a steady stream of very dedicated professionals coming to hear this talk, and they're very enlightened when they go out, and we're starting to see changes in schools in particular. I don't have enough doctors there. I want to get doctors and more doctors, so I'm trying to tap into OHSU because doctors need to hear this stuff, and they also need to change what they're telling parents when they're getting diagnoses. But anyway, the whole autistic burnout thing, back to that. If you go to a board where there are a lot of autistic adults speaking, Wrong Planet would be a good
mm-hmm.
example of one.
That's an online.
Yes, yeah, online forum, wrongplanet.com, and you go and you can wade through the forums for the right information. Now, here's a problem for neurotypical people because there's a lot of data,
yeah.
and there's a lot of cataloging, right?
True.
Yeah, so a lot of neurotypical people can't read Wrong Planet because it's just too overwhelming. I can read it, you can read it. Many autistic people can read it just fine. But if you go to that forum, you will see repeated over and over and over again, autistic burnout. And autistic burnout happens usually to people later in life, normally 30s to 50s. Is I think, and I'm going to, all of this is non-research, right? This is me telling you what I'm reading from volumes and volumes and volumes of anecdotal street stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
So normally 30 to 50s is what I'm seeing this in, though I am seeing it a lot earlier as these younger people get online and start talking, right? Because a lot of these people are just so in such bad prices that they can't even talk. But what happens is, you know, we were just talking about our abilities and how they zoom and soar.
Yeah.
And I have this theory, and I know it's a correct theory as well, and that is that we are late bloomers, right? So I would not look at art in my 20s. I would still sniff it, not as outwardly in my 30s. In my 40s, I'm embracing it. I'm a completely different person in my 40s than I was in my 20s. You know, we don't stop growing.
Right.
We continue to grow, and we get stronger and stronger and better and better and better. Whether neurotypical people are like that or not, I don't know. I think so. You know, we're human after all.
Yeah, right.
Something that we don't acknowledge very often, but autistic people are humans.
Imagine that, people.
Right? I mean, you know, we become these objects to doctors and parents and things as scary objects. But what happens with autistic burnout is that we are working so much harder to digest the world, to be in the world, to be a part of the world than a neurotypical person, that we actually hit these walls, and they're very similar to physical exhaustion. Similar enough that I've been diagnosed with physical exhaustion 7 or 8 times in my life. Diagnosed, people. I want you all to listen to that. Because to get diagnosed with physical exhaustion is almost impossible. You have to be so stubborn and so hard because your body is fighting you every step of the way to not get to that place. So a normal person who has the awareness of self, who isn't hyposensitive to their own self, right, can almost not get to that place because it's so dangerous and so deadly. Whereas an autistic person can not only more easily get there due to the hyposensitivity of themselves, but they are set up to get there because of how hard they're working to be, just to be.
Just to exist.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I walk into a room, for example, a new room, and the whole room is broken into bits and pieces. I see nothing. It's like darkness almost. And then it becomes this, like, digital camouflage. And then I start building those pieces together. And then I see a table. And, okay, now there's a chair. And there's a... This is all happening within the first 10 seconds of me walking into a room. And a normal person walks into a room, and if that room, it's already... Everything's presented to them. Okay, and that's 10 seconds of my life compared to a neurotypical person's life. So what happens is we hit this physical exhaustion wall and our cognitive abilities crumble.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when cognitive abilities crumble is that we become more autistic. We present as we did when we were children. And this is how I came to my own diagnosis when I was 47,
mm-hmm.
46, about 47th birthday. My father, it was on my birthday, actually. I watched my father die. He had a stroke right in front of me. I heard his last words. I saw him being medically taken away from the hospital he was in, where he had a mini stroke, to the more serious hospital in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And when I did all the business, I had to deal with the doctors. I had to, because Carla's a smart one, right? I had to talk with all the neurosurgeons and get all that. I had to talk my parents into the right time for the DNA and all that. I took care of the business there. I read books on grief. I went through my grief. I took some time off of work, all this good stuff. I felt like, okay, I'm ready to go on living now. Went back to work. I couldn't work. I could not do my job. And it wasn't because I was crying or in emotional distraught or whatever you name it. I had no ability to up-level anything. I could no longer walk into a room and build. It was digital. Everything was digital camouflage. It was, you know, the pavement was stones. The walls were little dots. It was horrible. And this went on for weeks and months, and I could not do my job. I mentally could not do my job. So my boss at the time, she actually had an Asperger's son, very interesting correlation there. And she just said, you need to go see a therapist because I was going to lose my job. I couldn't do it. And there was no reason why, right? Because
mm-hmm.
in America, you have 3 days to grieve.
Yeah, you
know, in other countries, it's 2 years. But there's a country, actually, that where you're mentally deemed unstable or insane for 2 years after the death of a parent or a child. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
You're given all this, you know, accommodation and leeway for 2 years. Anyway, in America, it's 3 days. That's your standard. Intel is 3 days. But Intel will give you as long as you need, really. Intel is a phenomenal company for disabilities. So went to, and let me tell you something. The thought of seeing a shrink or having therapy or any of that stuff, there is nothing in the world that would have driven me to see a shrink except for that. I can think of nothing except for that situation. So
I hear you.
So I found one. I looked a guy online. He did adult grief and all this good stuff. Walked into his clinic, sit down. So many funny things that happened in the first 5 minutes of our conversation. One of them was, he said, you know, have a seat in a leather chair. Well, there's three leather chairs. And I'm like, and two of them were back behind kind of a curtain. One was at his desk. One was, and I was supposed to infer that those weren't it, I guess, you know. Anyway, you know, I'm like, so, you know, you have a PhD, you can't count? There are three chairs, which leather, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
So anyway, all these, it was kind of comedic, actually, the first 5 minutes. But within 5 minutes, he basically said, I think you have Asperger's. And at that point, I started laughing. My arm just went down. Sorry. At that point, I started laughing because, you know, my mother read about Asperger's in the 90s in a newspaper article, and she put the article in front of me at home. One of my rare visits, I only visit Pennsylvania every couple of years.
Uh-huh.
One of my rare visits, my brother was there, and she goes, I think you have Asperger's. And my brother's laughing, ha, 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 you know. Funny story, my brother grew up to major in psychology, has his master's in psychology, and was diagnosed ADHD. He's horribly ADHD and completely impulsive. I mean, so my mother had two, you know, special needs kids, didn't even know about it. But anyway, she goes, I think you're Asperger's. And I was like, oh, whatever, I read the article, whatever. And so, you know, they teased me about it for a while. And, you know, she made a joke about it. After that session, I called her. I said, Mom, he wants to have me tested. She goes, tell him to save the pencil. I'll tell him that you're... Well, what was funny was as I walked around out after that, I said, you know, and he diagnosed me actually with autism spectrum disorder in the flavor of the new diagnoses coming out because, you know, it's a messy business, Asperger's, autism, whatever, because of the whole, when a person's 40, you have to go way, way back and say, well, did they have speech? And then was that speech for real or was it, you know, because I had memorized every commercial on television, So it's all kind of a messy business. I like the changes, actually. I'm one of the few that like the changes. I think they're good. But, you know, as I went around and I was telling my friends about this, they were like, oh, yeah. You didn't know?
Welcome to the club.
Exactly. But the fact is that what happened, and what here's the sad part. The sad part was he knew that I had this neurological difference, and the good part was he was able to protect me. So now I'm protected for my job. Here it is
mm-hmm.
now, right, with the ADA, they can't fire me at this point, per se. Right? They have to sort of accommodate and work with
right.
me. And by the way, I was never in any threat of that here. I was always supported, but now I have this ADA thing. So that's the good thing is I have the label, now I have the accommodations that I need, now I have... the bad part was that he couldn't tell me what the heck happened. He couldn't tell me about my sensory process. All he could tell me was, you don't have proper social communication, right? That's not helpful.
Which wasn't,
Not only is it not helpful, but it made me both deny and be angry about
sure.
the diagnosis. Because he essentially was only able to tell me that I was broken. Now, he was a great doctor, and he didn't think I was broken, but all his documentation.
To say.
Well, exactly, because that's what he's taught. All the stuff that they're taught is disability-focused, right? There wasn't any way he could help me. So the facts are is that I was having a cognitive crash. I had, ironically, a month before my father died, I was diagnosed with physical exhaustion. So it was a perfect trifecta for me to have a really serious crash. And it took me approximately 2 years to come back from that crash to where I am today. And today I'm pretty much where I was. I'm a little more tired, but I think that my body is physically giving out on me as I continue this cycle of crashing. And that my life, as my father's before, is shortened by this cycle. And that, again, why I'm saying I need to rethink my life right now if I want to have quality of life and, in fact, live. So my father in his death gave me life through this knowledge.
That's very, very powerful.
Yes.
It's very powerful. And I think about autistic burnout, and I wonder, if I'm heading towards that path a lot of different times. I think that might be the case, and I know I've read stories of others online, and I was hoping that you might be able to kind of describe it to our listeners who might not be sure exactly what that is, and maybe they were, maybe they have children that are on the spectrum, and maybe they're worried about them, and wondering what that might look like, and is it preventable? Are there certain signs? You said you had been diagnosed with physical exhaustion, or are there other diagnoses people might say? I'm trying to think, like, when I was young, people would say, oh, so-and-so had a nervous breakdown, or
mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think of what the lingo they used back then to maybe describe autistic burnout, but before it was even, coined as such. How can we help people recognize this so that they can either prevent it or be able to, get help once they're going through it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So far my experience personally has been at the other side, so I wait till I crash and then I go, oh, hey. And, after you crash, right, my abilities to function in everyday life are significantly impacted. And what really gets impacted are my sensory processing and my executive functioning, right? I have no ability to put two thoughts together. I have no motivation. I have no, and it kind of almost appears in to an observational person, a person observing, it would appear almost like depression, except that, I don't have any reason to be depressed. I'm just exhausted, right? So what I'm learning right now, and I'm going to give this chair up here in just a little bit, what I'm learning right now is to take care of myself before it happens. I have to do this for my life. I have no doubt that I'm headed for a very bad place physically. If I don't learn to, A, recognize it earlier, and B, take care of it, and that's why I'm such a stickler about advocacy and accommodating and support.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I have found is that through advocacy, accommodation, and support, I have more ability to do things that I couldn't do before. And, a very small part of autistic burnout is what I call token management, right? So it's one of the first things I try to teach neurotypical people. It's along the lines of when I walk into a room in that first 10 seconds, all that work that I'm doing is using up so much energy. And an autistic person has only so much energy during the day, and I call these tokens. You get these tokens in game?
Video game, right?
Yeah, right. You get a handful of tokens, and when you go stick those in machines, when they're out, they're out. You don't get to go back to the mommy bank for more. And so autistic people have a set number of tokens, And so do neurotypical people, but I want to caution us to blur those lines, because autistic people are A, either burning through the token so much quicker, or B, they simply just don't have that many to start with, that it behooves you to think of it as a very unique thing. I'm working with one kid right now who has an incredible small amount of tokens in his life, but we have managed to accommodate him such that he's always aware of those tokens and he's using them sparingly enough that he's actually able to focus on the important things, right? So we need to filter out the crap things in our life and focus on what's important. We need to prioritize more. If you Google a story called The Spoon Theory, she explains this whole token concept really well. And one of the things she says is, you know, every day, each and every day, this woman is living with lupus. And lupus is similar in this way, right? Each and every day, she's like, I have to make decisions about what's important in my life. I have to prioritize, do I want to get up and make soup, or do I want to finish writing this paper? Because I don't have enough energy to do both. And even in younger autistic people, you have to prioritize the things that are important to do. And you have to make those trade-offs and those weigh-offs. And so for me personally, I have been practicing doing that trade-off and that weigh-off and those prioritizations and then demanding accommodations and support for the things that I can. And the end result is that I have been working at this is, I just started a new job at Intel in really high visibility job, in a really high visibility group, working, you know, where the bonuses and everything's tied directly to the group in a lot of different ways. And a job like that in the past, by the 6 month mark, I would have been in the hospital at least once for a panic attack, probably several times. I would be managing, you know, my blood pressure and my all these other things. I feel perfectly fine because I'm prioritizing outside of my job. I'm aware of this stuff, and I'm demanding support and accommodations where I need it. This goes to directly ties into the whole concept of theory or therapies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I meet these kids all the time who are in 20 hours a week, 10 hours a week of therapy every single week and going to school full-time, and their parents are like, why is little Johnny melting down? Well, geez, I wonder.
Yeah.
Little Johnny is being driven straight into a wall of exhaustion. He's being driven, and as you drive him into the wall, instead of getting less autistic, he's getting more autistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because this whole biomed thing, and we can have a whole other session on biomed, but biomed is really about, it's at its core, is about when an autistic person feels good, they appear more normal. They appear more neurotypical. They have more, quote, skills. Well, yeah, because our executive function is working, our sensory processing is working, and, hey, by the way, because those things are working, I feel supported, not anxious. Now I can pay attention to you a little bit.
Right.
Now my social communication isn't broken. Voila. Right? This is biomed. This is the whole secret of biomed. I'm not cured.
No.
I am.
No, you're cured. Yeah.
So when you're driving your little autistic Johnny to 20 hours of therapy, you're worn out. He's worn out. He's in school all day. And by the way, now he's acting more autistic. And here's the deal, folks. Those kids who are violent, who are acting out, that's called survival. Those of us who have that are the ones who are going to survive in this world. The kids who aren't acting out, those are the ones that you should be really, really, really afraid for. You need those kids that are acting out and hitting. They're telling you, that's communication. They're telling you,
letting you know something.
That you're killing me. Please back it off at this point. I need this backed up. I need something is killing me, right? Because autistic kids aren't born violent, right?
No.
They're not born, autistic people are as a whole, as a group, are the gentlest, kindest group of people I've ever had the pleasure to meet. So when they're when they're hitting, when they're going, you know, what you would say crazy, you know, violently hitting something or whatever, that they're communicating with you, hey,
something's
yeah. 90% of the cases that I get presented with, when the therapy sessions are backed off, the parents start relaxing about autism, this thing, you know, that's bothering their child, right? They start relaxing that, hey, you know, Carla's really weird, but I wouldn't hate it if my son grew up to kind of sort of be weird like that. I could live with that,
yeah.
You know?
Weird and happy.
Exactly. You know? When they wrap their little parent heads around that, then the kid starts to feel, hey, now I'm not, I actually have some tokens for, like, things I want to do, right?
Yeah.
And things magically get better. I had at least one of the parents that I talked to completely pull a kid out of therapy, and all of a sudden their kid is social. I mean, like, really social.
You'd think that'd be contrarian, but there's a reason why. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's, yeah. Autistic burnout is, it's scary. It's real. It's deadly. I can tie you to lots and lots of research that shows stress and death. You know how they're tied. They're very tied.
Yes.
And it's, I think, the number one thing we should be looking out for as caregivers and friends to autistic people. Parents.
So if I'm a parent listening in today and I'm thinking, well, how do I help my child who is melting down? They are experiencing sensory overload. Maybe they've used up their tokens. What can I do to help them during the day at school when they're not near me to be able to just kind of navigate through and be okay?
Yeah, so here's where I have to make a plug for my ASD board. Because if you go to Carla's ASD board, and yes, it is called that, literally.
Literally, yeah.
I'm not real imaginative with names here.
That makes it easy to find.
So one of the places that you can navigate to, I think is really, really powerful, is the IEP. So all of my teachings and all of my work is really encompassed in the photo section. So you go in the photo section, there's all these different albums. You go to the album called the IEP, and now I talk about the IEP stuff and how do you accommodate a kid, an autistic kid in school. First, understand that there is absolutely nothing at all about today's schools that are autism friendly. Understand that when your child is going into a public school or even an autistic school, I have gone to a bunch of autism schools too, and they're not real friendly either. Just understand that there really isn't anything friendly about those sorts of environments. The lighting is fluorescent, and we have fluorescent in this room, but if you notice, it's very chill.
It's
very chill, right?
You
because
hear the
at Intel, if we had the lights at Intel, like we are in the public schools, we would have engineers revolting. In fact, they used to, and that it had been changed. You will notice as we walk through that people have these roofs over their cubicles.
Oh.
Yeah, that prevent the light. And then I actually have facilities come and take the lights out from over mine. So we're very funny about our lighting at Intel. Well, we need to be just as accommodating in our schools about the lighting, and we're not. So that's just, and that's one aspect. The acoustics are normally crap. People are touching you in the hallways. It's a terrifying experience for an autistic kid. So, you know, I do a really cool presentation to parents about little Johnny and little Jackie, one NT, one autistic, go to school, they're twin brothers. And they go to school, and by the time you get on the bus, and by the way, the diesel smell on the bus, right? And you got the motion sickness. Many of us are motion sickness people.
Yeah.
So we're trying not to puke. We're being, oh, and by the way, let's throw bullying on top of all of this,
yeah,
right?
On top of everything going on.
Right? By the time I get to school, I'm spent. I'm done.
You're just starting your day, yeah.
And now the bell rings.
Yeah.
By the way, those bells.
Really?
Really?
The bells, yeah.
The bell rings. Okay. And now I'm supposed to what? Sit in school, be still, pay attention, and all this other stuff, which is okay for some kids. Other kids are not so inclined to sit. I'm kind of a mover when I learn. So again, all these rules. So how do you get around that and still have an inclusive environment? I want an inclusive environment for my kids. Everybody should insist on an inclusive environment for your kids, but the mistake parents make, and teachers, when you say, I want an inclusive environment or inclusion, is they just toss the kids into the deep end of the pool and throw them right into the 30-kid classroom with all the stuff and say, survive. And that's not what we mean. What we're saying is we want the kid to have all the same access to the important stuff. The important stuff. And here let's talk about tokens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? At the beginning of each school day, and most junior highs and above, we have this thing called homeroom. Autistic kids should never be in it. They should come when that's over to school. Autistic kids should, as a rule, not ride buses. If you can advocate for a private ride to school, and most schools will provide this as a support, get it. If you can drive your kid to school, do it. If they can walk quietly to school, even better. I was fortunate. I was able to walk. And even when my school was 3 miles away, I walked to it because I tried to avoid the buses. Not important, right? Is it important they ride a bus? Is that going to somehow? No, right? So we're weighing every single thing that these kids are doing. Assemblies, never important for autistic kids. You know, they at the end, they have this thing called access period.
Mm-hmm.
It's a social thing. Not important. Not important. Take them out. They get to go home. So at the end of the day, they get to go home early. At the beginning of the day, they get to go. They get to come in late. Right? During the day, here's the way I like it set up with the kids that I work with. Every autistic kid has classes they really, really excel at and they're really good at. Therefore, the neurotypical kids actually respect the autistic kids because they're really, really good at a subject, right? So they actually get respect and some self-esteem because everything that you as a parent or caregiver need to be working on is about self-esteem because the whole world is working against that. So you need to be working for that. So you want them in and interacting and inclusive in the classrooms and those classrooms where they're going to succeed. Then they're on the complete opposite, because we never do anything gray. We always go black-white, right?
Right.
On the complete opposite side are those subjects that we really hate. And, by the way, we suck at them. Right? So
we want nothing to do with them.
We want nothing to do with them. It's going to be a hassle. Those are the classes that I want my autistic kids to do in a private room online. So I like to set up the day that so that, and then I try to get the schedule such that they're in class in inclusive rooms for 90 minutes. Or God, who invented 90-minute classes? Anyway, that's the norm today. So they're in their 90-minute classes with their, you know, kids. And by the way, group activities, not necessary. That's optional. Go away. You know, you don't have to do that. They're in those inclusive classrooms for those 90 minutes, and then the next 90 minutes is online. And then they have a quiet place where they go to lunch. And that's the key. That's the most important, one of the most important factors that everybody needs to understand. And public schools today will fight you on this, but don't let them, because they all have private places for their teachers. Impose upon those private places as your sensory-friendly room. I had a very sad, a very sad experience in a junior high. I went to teach science, engineering in a junior high. I think it was about 2 years ago now. And it was in a school with one of the kids that I work with. And the kid came and got me for lunch and started heading me down toward the cafeteria. And I had a little decibel meter in my phone built in, and the ambient noise in the cafeteria was over 90 decibels. This kid was expected to be in that room. Well, come on, folks. we're 1 in 50 now, 1 in 100. Let's say 1 in 88. Let's say we're 1 in 88. Okay. In that school of several thousand, there has to be other autistic kids. And by the way, there's also sensory processing disorder. There's also ADHD kids. There's a lot of kids that are not having fun in that 90 decibel room, right, cafeteria. So I go to the office with the kid in tow because I said, sweetie, I can't even get near this place. I can hear it from 40 feet away. I can't get near that place. Let's go to the office and find where we can go, because he had no clue where he could go. I was like, are you serious? No, that's where I have to go every day. I'm like,
right.
Well, and here's a kid, by the way, having 5-6 meltdowns a week. Huh. Shocking.
Yeah.
Right?
I wonder where that might be.
But see, parents, A, are not aware, or B, are aware, but aren't aware that they can fight to not do this. So I went to the office, and I said, hey, need to have a sensory-friendly place. Well, first I gave the kid I was with a dirty look. I said, no, not for him, for me. Then it was this big, uh-oh, now we have to accommodate.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now all of a sudden we have to accommodate, because now this is, you know, somebody that is, you know, up-leveled from a kid that we can ignore. So the only place they could find to accommodate me was in the germ room or the health room. So I had to, in theory, eat my lunch in the health room. Of course, I didn't eat my lunch that day. And by the way, I had to go that night to the emergency room for a panic attack. Because once you don't eat, right, you start spiraling down into this anxiety pool. So, you know, it was very important that I ate and drank everything that day. Well, they couldn't accommodate that. So, of course, you know, after that and after I got well again, I went after that school with a vengeance. And they ended up that they had a conference room. Well, no kidding. A conference room that, you know, what the teachers use. Well, okay, guess what? My kid's going to start using this. This
right.
is his room now. And so they all have a room that they can use for sensory-friendly places, and your kids should be, as autistic kids, should have access to that room anytime they want it. There should be no question as to them going. And let's be real careful that this isn't a seclusion room.
Right, yes.
A prison, right? It can't be a prison. It should be the same room that the teachers use, potentially, right? And there always has to be a place somewhere where that kid can go to avoid melting down, to avoid the stress, to avoid going to the hospital later that night for a panic attack.
Right,
which,
right.
Many of them probably are having, but as you know, the panic attack thing, they're
it just
not,
looks different,
not
yeah.
registering. Yeah, no,
yeah.
That's what melting down is about,
mm-hmm.
right? So we're holding it in and thinking that we're dying, right? They're just exploding, right? So here's the big thing. I meet a lot of these kids, right? They're having meltdowns 4 a week, 5 a week. Can you imagine? Could you imagine? And the parents aren't concerned about the meltdowns. The school's not concerned about the meltdowns. They're concerned
about what they perceive as the behavior.
Behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They're not concerned for the... I'm like, I go to these schools as an advocate. I'm like, it boggles my mind that you're not concerned about the liability of this child's health. Well, I guess by the time it actually kills them, they're out of the school and they get away with it. I don't care. I'm concerned about the health of
right.
the child. So it's a...
Yeah, you...
Long story.
Yeah.
but it goes into good
yeah.
detail about
Absolutely.
How you accommodate a kid in a school environment. I do very similar stuff myself here at Intel. I pick what's important for me to be at, what isn't important. The social events that we have,
mm-hmm.
only if I have the tokens for it. If I don't have the tokens for it, even though it's in theory, a mandatory event, you know, all this good stuff, you know, managers, whatever, and I'm the manager, yada, yada. There are I just can't do
Sometimes
it.
It's just, yeah, and I'm sure over time you know, are you going to be running out of tokens that tight?
Right. Or I go 4 or 5, 10 minutes, I let everybody know I'm going to be here during this time. Perfectly acceptable way to get out of, killing myself
mm-hmm.
around my job.
Right. And I think, you know, when you're accommodating the kids, you're accommodating the adults, they're going to, those tokens, that you're going to find that they're going to have more to be able to do the things that, you know, they're expected to do in the school. I was just kind of, boy, we've been talking for almost an hour now, and done by so quickly. And this is so great. And we can continue talking if you want, or we can go ahead and...
Let's take a break.
Take a break.
Yeah, let's take a break. It's a good ending. We have actually a couple of segments in here that
yes.
you can stop and start if you were interested in doing that.
I think
that.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's take a break because I could use one.
Okay.
Just kind of calm down a little bit. But do you want to wrap it up?
Okay. So that was the interview that we had with Carla. I hope you enjoyed that. We obviously talked about some very serious topics to do with autistic burnout, token theory, and I'd like to have you have the opportunity to be able to listen into her other interview because she goes into a little bit more depth on other things as well. If you have not been to Carla's website, it's actually on her Facebook page, Carla's ASD page, and if you Google Carla Fisher, K-A-R-L-A, Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, and Carla's, K-A-R-L-A, apostrophe S, A-S-D, page, you will be able to find those places as well. And make sure that you check out the different slides, the different information she has in her notes section. She's got some great things there. Different links to her wiki where it goes more in depth with her backstory. And stay abreast of the different things that she's doing. If you're in that Portland metro area and you have the opportunity tomorrow, go ahead and visit her at the Path to Employment Seminar from 1 to 5, and you can get more information about that at the AutismSocietyOregon.org website. So I'm going to go ahead and close our show down for today. I apologize again for the little snafu with the audio there, but sometimes those things happen. I hope you did take the conversation that we had as useful information. And please let us know what other types of things you would like us to talk about. Subjects that are of interest to you are very likely of interest to others as well. So if you would like to be on our show yourself, or you know someone who would like to be, or you just want to give us some feedback, you can email us at info, I-N-F-O, at autismempowerment.org. If you wanted to reach me personally, I can be reached at Karen at autismempowerment.org. And that's Karen with a K, K-A-R-E-N. Thank you so much for listening into our show today. We hope that you will check out our on-demand archives for a lot of different wonderful topics pertaining to the autism and Asperger communities. And we will be doing some new shows shortly. I look forward to having that schedule up for you and having you come back again. Thank you. Goodbye.